Well, in our study of Mark's Gospel last week, we concluded with the lights of the arrest party just flickering in the distance at the edge of the Garden of Gethsemane, where Jesus and his disciples had been spending the night. Now, led by Judas, a large party of soldiers arrive. The size of it probably due to the high profile that by now Jesus had and the seriousness with which the authorities regarded the threat from his words and his actions. But it was dark, and they needed to know who it was that they should arrest. So Judas, with a pre-prepared sign, comes up to Jesus and greets him in the customary way with a kiss. It was a sign of respect and affection, fairly commonplace in the time. But there are different words used for kiss, and the one used here paints a dreadful irony. Because it is the word that is used for the most intimate of kisses, even a kiss between lovers. You see, this is far more than a formal, respectful greeting. It is therefore perhaps the darkest thing of all that happened that night. Well, it seems that one of the disciples has come prepared for a fight. Mark doesn't tell us who he is. But I wonder if you could guess, who might it be? Mark, who's writing so close to the events, probably wanted to preserve the anonymity of that disciple. But John, who was writing over 40 years later, identifies the disciple as Peter. Who would be surprised by that? But the rest of the disciples, their nerves completely cracked, get up and run away. And then we're told about this young man. Now the verses add nothing to the story. Why are they here? Who is this young man? The verses don't appear in the other Gospels either. Well, one fairly good answer, I think, could be that the young man was none other than Mark himself. Could it be his way of saying, I was there? Without mentioning his name at all. Had he perhaps been in the garden listening to Jesus pray whilst the others were asleep? That would clearly explain, wouldn't it, how Jesus' prayers were recorded. When we read the book of Acts, we learn that the headquarters of the Jerusalem church actually took place in the house of Mary, who was Mark's mother. And so it's possible that the Last Supper also took place in that house. And so Mark could have been present there in the shadows and would have followed maybe the disciples to the Mount of Olives and now to the Garden of Gethsemane. I think that's a fairly convincing explanation. Mark was there at that moment. Well, we pass on to the trial where things are quickly moving to their inevitable end. The Sanhedrin at this time had full powers over religious matters, but it had no power to inflict the death penalty. Its object tonight was to prepare a charge on which the criminal could be tried before the Roman governor. Now, on one reading of this account, you would be shocked by how little attention was paid by the authorities to their own rules for conducting a trial. It shouldn't have taken place at night. It shouldn't have taken place outside the allotted place for such hearings in the temple precincts. And it certainly shouldn't have taken place at the time of a great feast like the Passover. Witnesses should have been examined separately. And for their evidence to be valid, it must have agreed in every detail. In all these ways, they failed their own rules. Well, another more gentle interpretation might say that this was only a pre-hearing before the main event, so taking place informally in the home of the high priest, and therefore not quite governed by the same rules. Well, what is undoubtedly true is that the witnesses that they gathered together could not agree, and many indeed bore false testimony. And so the hearing was going badly wrong. The high priest took things into his own hands. And in so doing, asked the very kind of question which the law totally forbids. He asked Jesus a leading question. It was forbidden to ask questions which, if answered by the person on trial, could lead them to incriminate themselves. No man could be asked to incriminate himself. But the high priest bluntly asked Jesus if he's the Messiah. And Jesus, perhaps wanting the whole thing to be over, gives him his answer. Yes, I am. So the Sanhedrin rub their hands with glee. They have what they wanted. They have a charge which merits the death penalty. But it's chaotic. It's, in one way, illegal. And in this, the only person who seems to stay controlled, courageous, and determined throughout is Jesus himself. And what of Peter? Peter, who was most likely the one who had just a little while before cut off the ear of a temple soldier. He had shown the reckless courage of a man who would take on the whole mob by himself. Surely now it would be rather sensible just to lie low. Not to travel to the courtyard of the very high priest himself, whose servant he'd just cut an ear from. But Peter had said, "I will never leave you, Jesus." And so while the others fled, he was keeping his words. So imagine him sitting huddled under his cloak outside, perhaps by the fire. And as the flames spark up on one instance, his face is illuminated and his identity is questioned. He denies he knew Jesus. But even then, once he is challenged, he still stays around. Prudence would suggest that he ought to drift off into the darkness of the night. And then the cock crows. Now, someone has done research into the most common time for cocks to crow. And apparently it's between 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning, so early morning. By this point, Peter has reached his breaking point. But then 999 men out of 1,000 would have reached their breaking point many, many, many times, many hours before. So let's not give Peter too hard a time. We should do well to be amazed by his courage rather than shocked at his fall. He was a good, full-hearted disciple, and he failed in a way that most of us even, might fail when put under that kind of scrutiny. If Peter acknowledged that he was one of the disciples, he would probably have suffered the same fate as Jesus that day. Might we ever face the same kind of questioning in a country where to be a follower of Christ is illegal? And what would we say? Well, there's another important thing to consider here. Where even did this story come from? It must have been Peter himself. If I was Peter, I would have certainly not recounted this to anybody else. I'd have wanted it covered up. But he's honestly and humbly shared this. And remember, most of Mark's material comes from Peter. He shared it with Mark, and Mark has put it in the gospel. It shows a great depth of honesty and humility that made him into just the kind of person that God could use. And so later in the gospel accounts, we see Jesus reinstating Peter. Peter, the rock upon whom God is going to build his church. And if you read the book of Acts, you meet Peter, the confident, passionate witness and preacher, speaking to the disciples and preaching on the day of Pentecost to literally thousands of people. Peter, who himself appeared twice before the Sanhedrin in Jerusalem and directly defied them. Peter, the very first bishop of Rome, who according to Christian tradition was crucified under Emperor Nero around 64 AD. An event predicted by Jesus and recorded in John's Gospel. So it was the humbled Peter who was able to speak powerfully about God's grace in his life, how he had forgiven him and restored him. It was the Peter who had got to the end of himself who found the beginning of God. It was the Peter whose biggest failure became the turning point in his life. And so it can be for us. Our biggest failures can be the turning points in our lives if we face up to them, if we're honest about them, if we acknowledge that God's grace and love are always there, and if we bear witness to that. I think I've said this before, but the thing that really drew me into faith was when I was at university in Cambridge, and I heard someone, it was a professor, I think it was a professor of mathematics speaking at the Christian Union, and he spoke about his failures in life. And it was the first time in 3 years in that illustrious context of Cambridge University that I'd ever heard an academic professor talking about the fact that they were a little bit flawed. And something gripped me inside, and I realized that he was being brutally honest. And he spoke about the grace of God in his life too. Now, we've all got stories to tell about that kind of work, but some of us, I think, are a bit frightened. We bury them inside. We don't talk about the things that have gone wrong. We don't talk about the grace of God that have brought us through those things and out the other side. Can I encourage us to do that? You see, one such person who did that was the man who wrote Amazing Grace, John Newton. He began his life as a slave trader. He met God, totally turned his life on his head. He ended his life as a pastor, as a priest in Buckinghamshire. He wrote some amazing poetry and hymns. He wrote the words to Amazing Grace, which we're going to sing together now. And as we sing these words and remember his humility, remember Peter's humility, remember how God used that humility powerfully, let's remember the words of St. Paul, who said, "It's by God's grace that I live, and when I am weak, then I am strong."